The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
And thank you very, very much indeed. Now, we are joined on the phone by my good colleague, Joe Duffy. Hi, Joe. Good morning. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Marion. How are you?
Now, tell me about the children of the revolution. We're having a look at some aspects of 1916. Tell me about the children, who they were, how many of them there were. I'm talking about the children who died.
Well, I now reckon I've been doing this for about a year and a half. I've stumbled upon the project accidentally. I was asked to do a paint an Easter egg for the Jack and Jill Foundation. I couldn't come up with an idea. And then I said, Jack and Jill children, Easter 1916, and many children were killed, and nobody seemed to have a definitive answer. I started looking through death certs, names, newspapers, and so far, I believe, and primarily from death certs, that in the week of the Easter Rising, 40 children aged between 2 and 16 were killed during the Easter Rising as a direct result of the fighting, crossfire, individual shootings, shot by one side or the other, some very savage attacks on families, especially around the Church Street area by the British South Staffordshire Regiment. So 40 children, on Easter Monday alone, Marion, I reckon 9 children were killed. One of the first casualties of the Easter Rising happened just after midday up behind the forecourt. John Francis Foster, 2 years of age, in his pram, beautiful summer's, beautiful April day,
yeah,
like today indeed, being wheeled, the mother going for a walk from Stony Batter heading towards town on the bank holiday, comes to a barricade at Church Street, and there's a charge on the barricade by Lancers, the shooting follows, and John Francis Foster is shot dead in his pram. That's one of the first casualties of the Easter Rising. Paddy Featherston, over the other side of the city, lived in Dorset Street. Marion, the melee begins. Remember, Dublin up to that had been fairly quiet. So Monday, yeah, Easter Monday, bank holiday, shooting breaks out, horses, explosions. What do children do who are living in one room and tenements up in Dorset Street? They're invariably on the street anyway. They all hail down to O'Connor Street with their box cars and their hand carts and their excitement. Patrick Featherston runs down with his hand cart and his mates. He gets shot in the thigh just at the top of Parnell Street. We don't know by who. His pals run back and say, Mrs. Featherston, quick, Paddy's been shot. She runs down. Her son is now bleeding from the thigh. You wouldn't normally die from that.
Yeah.
But the place is in chaos. She puts her son in the handcart and tries to get him around to Jervis Street Hospital, again through the melee and the chaos. And by the time she gets him to Jervis Street Hospital, Paddy Featherston is dead. So 40 children in that week, each of them with the most, by the way, a lot of them, 20 families came to the ecumenical service last week, which we're broadcasting tomorrow.
Yeah.
20 families, 20 children, of which I have death certs, and of which the death certs tell me the child was shot in Easter week or died from bullet wounds or cannonading, as they call it. 20 families I've no contact with. So the children, the problem was, Marion, they were all, as I said, very young. They'd no direct descendants, obviously.
Obviously,
there was,
yeah,
chaos, and they've been, in some, not all of them now, but a lot of them have just simply been forgotten, but 40 children.
40, and you had 20 families.
I had 20 families at the service last week, and as one of the families said, it was like the funeral service they never had, because in the chaos that week, one of them was buried in an egg box up in Glasnevin, taken up by his father and nobody else. Remember, there's a curfew on in the week that's in it between 7 and 7. So there may be one person allowed to attend the funeral. That would be the father, and, you know, hand carts, box cars. Some of them didn't get funerals. Most of them are buried in a communal grave in St. Paul's there in Glasnevin, some in Dean's Grange, some in Mount Jerome. The breakdown is 30 boys, 10 girls. I reckon about 8 Church of Ireland, 32 Roman Catholic, and every one of them was killed between the two canals in Dublin. So in that relatively small space,
yeah,
in the capital city, a massive death toll. That's just children, and it's only a glimpse. It's not meant to be a historical analysis of anything. It's just a glimpse of what was going on that week.
And the life on the street for kids because of the tenements.
Oh, because, like, I was doing one family, a child called John Kirwan, down in Nairn Place, which is just behind Westland Row Station. And they up to, you see, people moved very, very often and very, very quickly. Up to about a year before they moved to Nairn Place, they were living in South Cumberland Street, which is a street just behind Westland Row Station. People might know it. There's 28 houses on one side of the street. That's all, Marion. There's a, just a school and a railway station on the other side. In those 28 houses, 11 census, there were 600 people living in those 28 houses. 58 in one house alone. Unbelievable numbers. 300,000 in the city. The centre of the city was just full of children. And again, as I say, if we get a glimpse of the mayhem, the excitement, the first shop to be looted on Easter Monday morning was Noblet's Sweet Emporium. Why did they go for Noblet's? Because most of the kids in Dublin in 1916 knew nothing of Easter eggs except what they could wish for looking through a shop window. What was one of the first shops to be taken, so to speak, in the Mallee? That was Noblet's. What was the first thing to be taken by the kids? Their Easter egg or whatever. So they hadn't, in one sense, Easter Monday morning started without a care in the world, and by that evening there was everything had changed. Everything had changed.
That's for sure. Your programme is on tomorrow. Is it? Is there more information, or is it just the religious?
It's primarily a prayer service. It's the children from city. It's the first time anyone has done anything. A documentary, hopefully, is down the road, but we just need more information. And that's why I've set up a P.O. Box 1916 Dublin 3. That's free post to try and get more information. I'll put all the names of the children. I'm forever tweeting them and forever using any method I can to get them out, and the hope that people will remember, or a name might ring a bell, or even the address might ring a bell. But the service tomorrow is primarily a prayer service. The names will be read out. There's a beautiful piece of music specially composed by Declan O'Rourke, and then the children of City Quay do a number of poems and readings, and the Minister for Children spoke at it, and Emily Logan spoke at it.
Right.
So it's primarily a half-hour prayer service.
Right. OK, well, that all sounds lovely. Listen, before I go, or before you go, were you at the Brian Boru thing?
Yes, I was up there again this morning. I was up there twice yesterday. Yeah, it's incredible. It's absolutely fantastic. The biggest event in Clontarf since 10/14.
You were there too, Sinead.
Yeah, I was there yesterday. We kind of didn't plan to go when we went for a cycle, and we saw what was going on in St. Anne's. We said we'd have a look, and it was just the most fantastic event. There was hundreds and hundreds of men and women in full regale and just really going at it with each other. The screams, the noise levels.
A bit like Temple Bar, was it?
Yeah. Well, I hope if tourists were disappointed by Temple Bar the night before that they did get there, they might get there today.
And you, Joe?
Yeah, it was absolutely fun. There's a great buzz around it. It's the biggest event ever, I think, in Clontarf, apart from 10/14, obviously, but with less casualties this time. And there's a very good. Come early and take your time and plan your route out to Clontarf. You might have to come by a long boat to get in today. It's so busy. But plan your route and you get in. And there's hundreds of acres in what is probably, after the Phoenix Park, the most wonderful park in
lovely
the country.
Lovely park, yeah. Absolutely lovely. God, I just remarked at the outset, I didn't know that Brian Boru was so big. But obviously he's got a lot of fans. Anyway, Joe, thank you very, very much indeed for that. And good luck to all who are going out to Clontarf for today's version of events. Now, this, I just mentioned Clontarf because it's, as it were, because it's there. I should say that we've been joined in studio now also by Eunan O'Halpin and Lorcan Collins. Lorcan Collins does 1916 walking tours. Eunan is Professor of Modern Irish History at Trinity College Dublin. And Noreen and Philip are still with us. Can I go back for a moment to the papers today and the discussion about whether the royal family, the British royal family, should be invited here for 1916 celebrations. What's your reaction to that?
Well, when I first heard this a few weeks ago on a rival radio station, I somewhat flippantly said, well, maybe we should invite a Prussian royal, because after all, the royalty that, in a sense, some of the rebels at least thought might replace the British crown was to be a Hohenzollern one. But I'd be concerned as a citizen, because I think this is liable to focus the discussion on security issues to do with whatever presence is there. I think it's going to distract from debates and discussions which Irish people And the British as well should have about the nature of not only of the Rising, but the Home Rule crisis, the Ulster crisis, the whole, in a sense, the whole basket of commemorations that we're now engaged with will start hinging around whether it's, you know, Prince Andrew or whatever. And I think that's unfortunate. I think we're liable to get attached to it then, competing sets of demands for who's to say what, who's to say sorry for what, and so on. I don't think 2016, other than through, you know, in a sense, probably the normal protocols of an ambassador present or something, I think it'd be much, much easier than having a royal. A royal would distract attention for everyone from core debates we still haven't settled.
Feels more like a family affair, but then I suppose you do invite outsiders to a family affair as well. What do you think, Lorcan?
Well, Marion, I have a number of issues with a potential royal visit for 2016. First of all, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this was a Republican uprising, and for some, a socialist Republican uprising. By inviting the royals, we're only encouraging them that they are legitimate figures of some authority in Britain. I don't
recognise... Well, they are.
Well, they are non-democratic.
She's the head of state.
She may be, but not for everybody in Britain. I had the pleasure of living in England amongst the people there for a few years in the late 1980s.
Now, listen, you may not agree with monarchy, but the fact of the matter is that the Queen of England is legitimately the Queen of England.
Well, not for everybody over there, Marion. And I am an English Republican as much as I'm an Irish Republican. And I don't want to see the King of Spain or the King of or the Queen of Britain or Prussia or whatever. Mm. I would like to see the democratically elected British Prime Minister over in Ireland for 2016. I would be absolutely fine with that, okay? There may be some security issues with it, but
you
to take away...
You can bet your bottom dollar there would be security issues.
I would accept it. I would accept it, but it would be absolutely incongruous to have a British Crown representative over here.
Well, I was listening to some clips that I'll be playing later on earlier this morning. And, I mean, the enemy for those that participated in 1916 was the British Army. You know, I mean, because times have wrought on and wrought on and wrought on, and because of politics in Northern Ireland, and you don't want to be saying the wrong thing or anything that's insensitive. But it just seems to me that the head of the armed forces of the British Army, and we're celebrating an attack on the British Army, seems slightly incongruous. What do you think, Philip?
I'm just reading Declan de Braden has an article in the Sun today. He talked about Dermot Ferrater saying that he set the cat among the pigeons, as he described it, saying that it might give credence to the notion that the Rising was unnecessary. The British were going to give home rule anyway when the First World War ended. That's
Well, many a person held that point of view.
Well, now, a very strange thing happened, Marion. This may sound really weird, but I interviewed my own dad. My dad was 20 in 1916.
Right.
Now, he was very heavily involved in the War of Independence, and I mean heavily involved. But I remember asking him at the time about the 1916 Rising when I talked about it and what was going on. He says the place was mayhem. He says they hadn't got a gun or a bullet up in Monaghan at all to half the time. And we're talking about a Rising. And he says the way the Rising happened, he himself, in relation to the Rising, he had two trains of thought on it. He first of all said it shouldn't have happened the way it happened because Owen McNeill had issued an direction to stop it.
That's right.
And he says that when that happened then, he says there was topsy-turvy around at the moment. He says, you're going to have a Rising, you should have a decent Rising. that's the way he put it. Have a good one or have none at all. Now, he was on two sides of the fence in that argument. But in relation to the Royals coming, my dad used to always say, and he drilled it into all nine of us, there's not a blade of grass out there worth a drop of blood. This was from a man who had seen a lot of blood. And he would now say, if he was alive today, and he'd be a fair looking specimen, but he would now say, look, if it's time, I'm putting forward his argument, that maybe it would be no harm if somebody came over to let them see how we've come on and what they did to us for 800 years and how we've progressed. That's the way he would look at it, I'm thinking.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the European Union, I mean, the French and the Germans had been through two world wars, and I mean, the European Union just seems to have been extraordinarily effective in achieving what it wanted to achieve. Well, some of what it wanted to achieve.
Marion, if I could add to this, as somebody who does walking tours in Dublin, the security clampdown during the Queen's visit to Dublin and Ireland a couple of years ago, it was an absolute nightmare. You couldn't get anywhere Yeah. We all had to stop work for the whole few days that she was over. Now, I don't mind the fact that we did that for Barack Obama because he had the decency to get in and get out within 24 hours. But she somewhat overstayed.
She was our honored
guest. That's fair.
I think most people are happy as our guest.
Our relations are really good between, you know, or have improved considerably. I mean, I think the timing of this was very unfortunate this week. And I think Dermot Ferriter is right. It does smack of a post-colonial inferiority complex. Yeah. I think if the Queen is here as part of the heads of Europe, the leaders of the world for 1916, I have no issue with it whatsoever. I do think that the people and the descendants of the people who are involved are very important in this. And I think what Joe Duffy is doing in relation to the forgotten children who were killed. The Sunday Times has a story today where James Connolly's great-grandson says that there should be a pardon for the people in 1916 before there is a royal visit. Justine McCarthy has a very good piece about don't brush the truths of the troubles under the royal's red carpet. I think these are all the issues we should be talking about, and the royals should be a secondary consideration way further down the road when there is a formal invitation issued, and it hasn't been issued yet. But the timing was wrong. But I would also say, when you talk about business being stopped in Dublin, it's very unfortunate that on a day like today where there's a commemoration in O'Connell Street, the commercial trade of Dublin has to go on. So there are, well, I don't know if it's there today, but certainly was last year, massive barriers in O'Connell Street that you can't see over because the shops are open behind them and you've got to go through turnstiles to get in to the commemoration of 1916. Contrast that with Clontarf and the exuberance of Brian Boru. That's what I'd like to see, you know, that an inclusive ceremony that is respectful, but that everybody's involved in, because it doesn't feel like that right now.
No.
Can I just say, I think the idea of a pardon for doing something which you feel was right, an act of rebellion, would be an insult to anybody involved. My great uncle was executed, my another great uncle was killed in the War of Independence. I cannot imagine either the relatives, my grandparents, whom I knew, are anybody seeking a pardon. Okay. This is daft. You fought. You decided that was the enemy, and you fought against them. Yeah, you had a trial. In James Connolly's case, he had a terrible death because he was wounded, but he wasn't whining and sort of trying to beat the rap. On the contrary, he died heroic. Why should you seek a pardon? That's madness.
I never thought of it that way.
It's a German-aided rebellion in the midst of a war against Germany, right? It's a war where it's a rebellion which, for many people, not only Unionists and not only Protestants and not only Northern Ireland, they regard it initially, in a sense, as an act of treachery. We may now see it differently and it may have played out differently. But I think the very idea that the people whom we've been brought up perhaps overly to venerate, that they should somehow, in addition, get a pardon, is just absurd.
I saw Michael McDougall was quoted today in the Sunday Hindu, I think it was, because his grandfather was Owen McNeill, and saying that the Rising was a bit of a damp squib, and would have been just that, a damp squib, had it not been for the subsequent executions, and that the War of Independence was fought in a very different way.
But the executions and also the mass deportations. As an example, my great-grandfather, who was leader of the volunteers in Tipperary Town, he was deported after the Rising, which he had not been involved because of the countermanding and so on. And lots of men, about almost 2,000, I think, people were deported, most of whom had not been actively involved in the Rising because of the countermanding and so on. And that spread, in a sense, the sympathy and the issue of it highlighted the issue of the arbitrariness of the executions, but it also spread in a sense discontent right across the country. And the contrast is partly with Ulster and the Ulster Volunteer Force and why the government had absolutely done nothing in terms of the UVF and its threat to fight against Home Rule, which is what started this mess.
The whole business of choosing the GPO, why did they choose the GPO?
Well, that's an absolutely easy question to answer, because today, if you're going to have a revolution, this is where you take over RTE. You want to be at the centre of communication within the state. All the buildings that they took had some relevance to the state structure. You know, there is a British historian called Charles Townsend who maintains that they took a motley collection of buildings. They were all very specific. You know, the city hall, where the city is run from, to give the impression of being in charge. They take the four courts, you know, to show that they are the legitimate judicial government of Ireland, if you will. Now, my theory appears to fall down when it comes to Jacob's Biscuit Factory and Boland's Bread
and
Mills.
Boland's
However,
Mills, yeah.
And the hospital,
were,
the South
they,
Dublin
they,
Union,
and the South
falls
Dublin
down
Union.
There.
However,
why didn't they take the railway stations?
They were
why didn't they take the telephone exchange?
Yeah,
they weren't strategically important.
Wait one sec. They also wanted to make sure that food production was kept, the wheels of food production were oiled, if you will. James Connolly said to Eamon de Valera, ask the bakers to stay behind and bake free bread for the people of Dublin, which would have gone down champion with the people. You know yourself.
Not like, too well.
They come running up to you going, our men are after taking over Stephen's Green. You know, there's a policeman shot dead at City Hall.
But and you see, Stephen's Green strikes me as odd as well. I think
it was you that was saying that.
You're surrounded by high buildings.
Absolutely. I think what we're hearing here is really odd because, I mean, the only Republican I know who wasn't directly involved in 1916 was in the city was Todd Andrews, whom I used to go and see, of course, former chairman of RTE. And Andrews was bitterly critical in retirement of what he saw as the complete mess that had been made of the Rising, even given that there weren't enough people to go around and so on, precisely because the key points that might have been taken to stop troops moving into the city and so on hadn't been taken. And instead, as happened again in 1922, the Republicans took the forecourts and then they moved to the Gresham Hotel and the Hammond buildings. This is just militarily madness.
Well,
you're just
Western
Row
was taken, Yunnan. So I mean,
yeah, but they didn't shut the telegraph office. The first cable with the news of the Rising went from Western Row.
Can I introduce a different slant onto this at the moment? When I interviewed my dad, he was a postmaster, you see, by profession, among other things. But in 1966, the then De Valera government, or the government at the time, brought in a pension for everybody who was around in 1916. And I remember my dad quoting, God bless us, he said, if we had all these people, we should have won.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, that archive is up now, isn't it? I mean, it is
the first part is up. Yeah. I mean, it's 300,000 files. They aren't all up yet. And the more we talk about it on the radio, the more government will be, I hope, hurried into releasing the material because it's amazing.
But you know, are you part of this committee that's organising, or what's that about? Are you part of that committee that's been set up to Dermot Fair, Maurice Manning, Martin Mansour?
Yeah, we're an advisory expert committee, but we're not asked matters such as, you know, should a British royal be invited?
Has that been discussed by the committee? Is what a question I should
have
asked.
Well, I'm not here as a member of the committee, and I'd be completely inappropriate. This is a high political decision whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with
Marion. Can I get back to Stephen's Green? Because Brian Hughes is going to be in with us at some stage, and Brian
is
an absolute expert on that. And one of Brian's points is that there are 11 roads leading on to Stephen's Green. There are 11 roads and laneways. So it's like a giant roundabout within the city centre. So if you can command that area, you also stop British troops from moving directly through that area. It's actually a very smart position. They just didn't have the necessary required troops. 400 or 500 were supposed to be used there. 35 men and 10 women turned up. So instead of taking all the high buildings, they dug themselves into the low ground, into foxholes and trenches. But you're within one night, the British are in the Shelbourne Hotel, raking the ground with machine gun fire. And that's where they escaped into the College of Surgeons then. So, you know, the initial plans were
very sound. They should have taken all the bridges over the canal. That was the obvious. That's what Republicans planned to do in 1922, although they didn't carry it out. Right, that stops people moving in and out. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You take the railway stations, which they didn't, except at Western Row. You do that. You damage the lines. You stop troops moving into Dublin. You stop communication between Dublin and the outside world. The rebels did none of those things.
The problem with the canals is there's nowhere to actually, you know, embed yourself. You're just standing there on a bridge like an open target. Now, if you had decent weaponry like Lewis guns, you can
You've just proved the opposite, because the one bridge that they invested properly with very few soldiers was Lower Mount Street. That's that was an extraordinary military success in rebel terms.
Tanks,
extraordinary.
I suppose, to its positioning, the houses there at Clanwilliam House and 25 Northumberland Road, fine. But like other parts of the canal are fairly indefensible when you think about it.
Not nearly as indefensible as digging slit trenches in Stephen's Green when you're surrounded by buildings out of which the enemy are going to pour fire.
I don't want to be too hard on Michael Mallon over that, because, I mean, he had 13 years in the British Army. He knew a thing or two. He had fought in India.
I know, they've done a lot of things wrong in the British Army, let it be said.
That's true. More than a lot, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever read Birdsong. At the end of it, I wanted to haul them off before tribunals, you know, of human rights. But anyway,
I still stick by the notion that for the most, the last minute plans for the Rising were quite sound in that the symbolism behind the buildings that they took was as important as their...
You take over a hospital like the South Dublin Union. What's the symbolism there?
Well, the point there was to try and stop troops from entering the city via,
Coming from Richmond Barracks.
Yeah.
Well,
you know,
I'm over the Mendicity Institute again.
That was smart because that backed up the forecourts, and you know, should any troops move along the quays, they would be met with.
But these are probably buildings primarily to do with helping the poor rather than with the conduct of military operations.
Yes,
or the exercise of oppressive government.
Well, you know.
You're full of admiration for them.
Absolutely. Like, I've invested 20 years of my life on a daily basis talking about the men and women in 1916.
But that doesn't mean they got everything right, militarily.
They're not infallible. They make mistakes. But for the most, our proclamation is one of the most beautiful declarations of independence in the whole world. The mere fact that it's to Irish men and Irish women is way ahead of its time. You know, women didn't have the vote at that stage, and women didn't get the vote till 1918, hilariously restricted to 30-year-old women alongside 21-year-old males. I've always loved the notion that some civil servant decided, yes, a 21-year-old man has the same intellectual capacity and decision-making capabilities as a 30-year-old woman, whereas, in fairness, it takes a long time to realise this, but it's the other way around. But like that fourth paragraph that's always quoted, you know, the Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights, equal opportunities to all its citizens, and goes on to declare its resolve to pursue the happiness and the prosperity of the nation as a whole. This is wonderful, wonderful stuff. And the fact that there were two women who were commandants in 1916, not just Countess Markovitz, but the famous and often forgotten Dr. Kathleen Lynn, who took over in City Hall when Sean Connolly and Sean O'Reilly were killed in action. There are no female commandants in the British Army or in the German Army or the French Army.
Okay, we will proceed with this somewhat further, and we will have some clips relevant to some of what we were talking about just now. But first of all, I'll take a break.
1850 715 150.